Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
In the years since, we've been eagerly awaiting, and now we're grateful that she is here with a brand new book, equally powerful, Music of the Ghosts, a book that tells the story of a woman who makes a return to Cambodia, where she has not been since she left as a child, as a refugee, and with some quite deep questions, not only what is Cambodia now, but she has some deep family questions, and namely, specifically, what happened to her father. There's a great mysteries in this as both present day Cambodia is revealed, but also what happened during the Khmer Rouge period for people who perished, for people who survived, and what this has meant for the state of things in Cambodia today. It's a powerful, extraordinary book, which you'll get some sense of tonight. She'll talk from it and talk about it, read a little bit from it. But you as readers will really get to immerse yourself in this really full novel that tells with great pleasure, great beauty, but also great horror in much of some of what unfolds in this book. Very painful, difficult things, but it's also part of acknowledging and knowing what happened there and what happens in places even today in other countries. It serves that way as well. But I comes to now. She presently is living in Malaysia. So she even was, is this today, April 25th? No, it's already April 25th in Malaysia, but not here. But she's been traveling around the U.S. We're delighted she's doing so. And tonight begins the sort of the West Coast conclusion to traveling around the U.S. We'll see her again in the future with other books. But you're in for a great treat tonight. So she'll read, she'll sign copies at the table here afterwards. If we have both of her books in The Shadow of the Banyan and this beautiful new Music of the Ghosts. So with that, for all of us again at Elliott Bay and here at the Seattle Public Library, we thank you for being here. And now please join in welcoming the extraordinary writer, Vade Ratner.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome. Thank you, Stasha. Thank you, Rick. It's so nice for me to be back here. But first, a special thank you to the Seattle Public Library, Elliott Bay Books, members of your wonderful community and all those involved in bringing me here. I was last here, as Rick said, in 2012 to launch my first novel, In the Shadow of the Banyan, at the Seattle Asian Art Museum. I believe it was at the invitation of Mimi Gates, who read the book after you recommended to her. And then later, I saw in Foreign Policy magazine when it listed a group of global thinkers, which include Melinda Gates, and she had listed In the Shadow of the Banyan on her reading list. So I'm so grateful to have the early support of these amazing individuals. I call them my devada, my angels. They have helped kind of give wings to my first book, and this is the reason I have the courage and the energy to take on another book. But before I speak about Music of the Ghosts, I like to share a bit of my personal history and how I became a writer. Born into a family of royalty in Cambodia, my life of privilege came to an end when the Khmer Rouge seized power in 1975. The Khmer Rouge regime, one of the most devastating and violent social revolutions in the last century, claimed the lives of nearly 2 million people, perhaps a quarter of the population. Among those perished were my father, my younger sister, and many beloved family members. Soon after the fall of the regime, in 1979, I set out with my mother on a treacherous journey across through the jungle and across the border to Thailand. 2 years later, we arrived in rural Missouri to start life anew. By the time I arrived in the United States, I had been educated, so to speak, in the extremes of human brutality, in the toxic potential of an uncompromising ideology, in ways that I would wish for no child. And I witnessed also unexpected and repeated acts of compassion. Nevertheless, I had little way to communicate what I had experienced. Toward the end of the regime, I had gone mute, withdrawing into silence. On arriving in the U.S., I spoke no English. Yet, even then, I knew that someday I would have to find a way to tell the story of what we lived through. What makes one a writer? Ask any group of authors, and we all have different answers. For me, there is an indelible link between stories and survival. I can recall from my earliest memory that my father told me stories, and those stories stayed with me even after my father was gone. Without them, I believe I would not have survived. I wrote my first novel, In the Shadow of the Banyan, to give voice to the loved ones I had lost. Through art, I wanted to make them live again. I didn't expect that a novel about a small country, about a war in a small country 4 decades ago, would be met with such a sympathetic reception from readers in all walks of life. Nor could I expect that this book would find its way around the world, published in 17 languages in places as diverse as Norway, Slovakia, Korea, and Brazil. I'm especially touched when I hear from readers who say they see themselves in my story, that reading the book, they experienced this ordeal as if having lived through it themselves, as if this journey through war and revolution were their own. The pain, the loss, the hope and love, the beauty I tried to articulate in the narrative of In the Shadow of the Banyan, they tell me, seems so familiar, so universal. Their reactions only reaffirm my belief that art and stories have the power to connect us, to help us discover our common humanity across the divides of geography, nationality, race, and religion. In the Shadow of the Banyan is a story of survival. My second novel, Music of the Ghosts, The Reason I'm Here, is about the survivors, people like myself, but also people who took part in the violence by varying degrees of choice and coercion. It's about the lives that endure after such trauma and the questions that haunt us. Music of the Ghosts is also a love story. It follows Tira, a Cambodian-American woman in her 30s who fled Cambodia as a child refugee and is now returning for the very first time after more than 2 decades from the safety of her adopted home, America. In the midst of this journey to uncover her past, Tira also rekindles her ability to love and to love with a passion she could not have expected. So while the novel explores the aftermath of genocide, I can assure you the story is not all darkness and despair. If anything, I write always to find hope, to find light. Tira's return to Cambodia is prompted by a letter she receives from an elderly half-blind man living on the grounds of a temple in Phnom Penh, the capital city of Cambodia. Disabled and impoverished, the elder survives, earns his keep by playing traditional music for various ceremonies and rituals. He's known to those around him only as the old musician. In the letter, Tira learns that the old musician may be the only one who can shed light on her father's disappearance decades ago amidst the fever of the revolution. The story is told in the alternating perspective of these two central characters. I will read to you now from excerpts from the beginning of the novel, first from the perspective of the older musician and then from the perspective of Tira. He feels his way in the confined space of the wooden cottage, hands groping in the dark, searching among the shadows through the blurred vision of his one good eye for the Sadhu. The lute has called out to him in his dream, plucking its way persistently into his consciousness until he's awake, aware of its presence beside him. It lies aslant on the bamboo bed, deeply reposed in its dreamlessness. His fingers inadvertently brush against the single copper string, coaxing a soft thud similar to the click of a baby's tongue. The old musician is almost blind, his left eye damaged long ago by a bludgeon, and his right by age. He relies much on his senses to see, and now he sees her, feels her presence, not as a ghostly apparition overwhelming the tiny space of his cottage, nor as a thought occupying his mind, but as a longing on the verge of utterance, incarnation. He feels her move toward him, she who will inherit the Sadhu, this ancient instrument used to invoke the spirits of the dead, as if in that solitary note he has called her to him. He lifts the lute to his chest, rousing it from its muted sleep, holding it as he often held his small daughter a lifetime ago, her heart against his heart, her tiny head resting on his shoulder. Of all that he's tried to forget, he allows himself, without reservation, without guilt, the reprieve of this one memory, the curve of her neck against his, paired in the concave and convex of tenderness, as if they were two organs of a single anatomy. He plays a song. He plays the song he wrote for her upon her entry into his world, into his solitary existence as a musician. I thought I was alone. I walked the universe looking for another. He remembers the day he brought his daughter home from the hospital, her breath so tenuous still that he wanted to buttress it with notes and words. I came upon a reflection and saw you standing at the fringes of my dream. He often dreams of her, not his daughter, but the little girl to whom this lute rightly belongs, except she's no longer a little girl. He wonders about the person she's become, the woman she's grown into. He dares not confuse one with the other, the young daughter he lost long ago, and the woman he now waits to meet. They are not the same person, he reminds himself. Tira feels a hand on her arm. She looks up and sees the flight attendant smiling at her. The young woman reminds her to bring her seat to an upright position. The plane has begun its descent into Phnom Penh International Airport. A terrain of slender sugar palms and straw huts comes into view, desolate and scarred, the earth a deep saffron color. For some reason, Tira expects to see more green, to be greeted by a lush tropical landscape of coconuts and teaks, emerald rice paddies, lakes and ponds filled with lotus and water lily. Instead, what lies below resembles a battleground, pockmarked by dark water holes and bomb crater-like gashes, a fractured geography. What can it tell her? What lies beneath those patches of gray and brown? What secrets does this wounded earth hold for her that she doesn't already know? Does it conceal in its crevices her father's dying scream, his shattered ideals and dreams, evidence of his alleged crime, the possibility of his redemption, as well as her own? The plane swoops down, then touches ground with a light bump. Her heart skips a beat. Tira clutches her shoulder bag to still herself. Inside are the valuables, her passport, some cash, and a couple of credit cards, the old musician's letter. My dear young lady, I don't know how to properly begin this letter. She's read it so many times she can recall it word for word. There's so much to say. It isn't a long letter, but the empty spaces between the lines resonate with inexpressible sadness, their parallel sorrows. I knew your father. He and I were. The words were crossed out, a single straight line running through them, as if the mistake was immutable, impossible to obliterate or retract by a new beginning. Tira was touched by its honesty, its self-revelation when she first read it. We were in Kampung Thom together during the last year of Pol Pot's regime in Selasdai, a prison. How I survived such a place, I do not know. Why I survived at all is a question that has plagued me until now. Tira feels the aircraft coming to a full stop. I don't know how much time is left or if it is already too late. I have in my possession 3 musical instruments that once belonged to your father. He would have liked you to have them. He would have liked you to know that some part of him lives, even if only in these instruments. In her mind, Tira hears the music of her father, Sadhu. She doesn't know why, but of all the instruments he played, she remembers the sound of this ancient lute most vividly. She remembers a song, not its name, but its melody, each note like a drop of pre-dawn rain on bamboo. She closes her eyes and lets the melody wash over her. So as the story unfolds, we learn that Tira and the old musician are drawn to each other, not only by their hidden interwoven history and by remembered melodies, but also by the questions they ask themselves. How do we account for the crimes we have committed knowingly and for the suffering we contribute to perhaps without knowing? What is possible to forgive? What does it take to atone? And what hope can there be for reconciliation, for redemption? Unlike my first novel, Music of the Ghosts is not autobiographical, but the question it confronts are deeply personal. The old musician grew out of my desire to know what happened to my father, who was taken away at the beginning of the regime by Khmer Rouge soldiers for who he was, not only a prince, but a pilot, a man of education, something the regime deeply feared. To this day, I can't say with absolute certainty what his ultimate fate might have been. I believe, though, that he did not survive long after he was taken away, and that he suffered profoundly before he died. The disappear can haunt us more persistently than the ghosts. We feel their shadows as our own. We never stop searching, stop longing for them. Thus, tears yearning to know the truth of her father's disappearance and her deep-rooted ties to Cambodia echo my own. Despite the geographical distance, the decades in America, the sanctuary and peace she has found in her adopted home, a part of her heart is still bound to that land, to those she loved and lost there. She is American and Cambodian, her identity challenged and forged anew at each turn. Yet, in other ways, Tira's passage through loss and discovery is a familiar universal journey, I believe. Even those of us fortunate enough to have lived a relatively comfortable life cannot help but recognize that our world is increasingly interconnected. Whether we travel or stay in one place, we come into contact daily with those of different backgrounds, experiences, and belief. Not all of us, like the characters in my novel, are refugees of war or survivors of atrocity. Still, even the most privileged among us, no matter where we live, over the course of a life, cannot escape heartbreak and loss. If we pay attention to the ones we love, if we're alert to the world we live in, we will confront pain and suffering. And how we respond can either deepen the suffering or pave the way toward healing. Music of the Ghosts is a love story because it traces Tira's discovery of a passionate love in the midst of a journey to understand and to reconcile her own, to reconcile with her own history with devastating loss. In a more personal sense, the novel is also a love story for a country that is my birthplace, for the beauty of the land, the poetry, the music that one hears to this day in the ensembles of the wounded and the blind. I was inspired in my writing by the countless street musicians I had spoken with during those early years of my return to Cambodia. These impoverished musicians, most crippled by war, would sit on the street and play these beautiful, haunting melodies. You could easily mistake them for beggars, but I recognize them more than just performers trying to feed themselves. They had so much to say in their music, in their expression, in their solemnity, and even in their silences. In Cambodia culture, music plays a vital role in every aspect of life, births and deaths, unions and separations, illness and healing. There is music offered to the gods, to the spirits, to ancestors, to travelers. Music is blessing, it's nutrient, it's medicine. When words fail, music becomes our other voice. I hope that Music of the Ghosts will speak to those of you who have been displaced and longed for home, to those who have suffered and dared to imagine a new beginning, to those who believe in the capacity of love to mend our wounds. And perhaps this reflects my purpose as a writer in times of separation to find love, in places of darkness to find light, in moments of fear and loss to find hope, amidst pain and discord to discover the possibility of music. I have dedicated the novel to the lives and the beauty that it inspired its pages. I would like to now close with one short passage from the novel that reflects the awe and inspiration I continue to draw from my homeland every time I return. They've reached an intersection. There are neither traffic lights nor stop signs. But like all the cars around them, they slow to a crawl. Looking past the couple of cars ahead of them, Tira expects to see a motorcade escorting a convoy of armored Fort Rangers, favored by high-ranking officials and oligarchs, or worse, a Hummer barreling down at 60, 80 kilometers an hour in a zone marked 20. No such vehicle emerges. Instead, she notices an older man, tall and stately, but otherwise dressed in the patched fur clothes of a mendicant, a bamboo cane in one hand and a cotton satchel on his shoulder. He takes a cautious step from the sidewalk into the humming traffic, then pauses, tapping the bamboo cane on the asphalt, swinging it from right to left, his head cocked to one side, listening, observing with all his senses. Then he lifts his free hand straight past his head and proceeds forward, weaving across the intersection. He's blind, Tira realizes in astonishment. Though he can't see, he raises his arm in the air so others can see him. Everything stills inside her. In this chaotic little city where traffic stops for no one, except out of fear for those with power, and fatal accidents occur daily, so it can seem human lives are as dispensable as those of chickens and pigs on their way to slaughter. This mute gesture feels like a revelation of sorts. Tira knows in this very instant that if all she has to take with her when she leaves this land is the image of the raised hand, she will have gained more than what she came with. She may never fully grasp the source of inhumanity, what drives the people to massacre one another, the potential for hate that lurks in every heart, or at what point ideals turn rancid with venom so that they poison and corrupt, murder the very beauty they aspire to create. What is clear before her is the simple fact that it takes conviction to do what this blind man does. In the absence of sight, when all is dark around you, it takes a deep-seated belief that others will answer your appeal, that their humanity will rise to meet your lifted hand, your raised hope, and in that brief moment, you cross the otherwise arbitrary divide between death and life. Thank you. I will take some questions now.
I was wondering how often you go back to Cambodia, and when you go, what is it like for you? What do you do when you're there?
Well, I'm living in Malaysia at the moment, so it's very close to Cambodia, so I go as often as I need it. I guess every now and then I need to put things in perspective, and I go there to feed my soul, so every chance I get, I hop on the plane, and it's just one plane ride away. When I'm based in, we still have a home in Maryland, so when I'm based in Maryland, I try to go twice a year. I get so excited when I'm preparing for a trip to Cambodia, and I imagine all these things that I'm going to do. And then I get on the plane and the excitement is still there. And then I get there and I start to see the landscape and the way I describe the landscape and, you know, how it's fractured and how it's wounded is how I often, that's how Cambodia often greets me. And I feel like it is a reminder of how much has been broken, how much has been destroyed. And it is my duty to try to rebuild what is broken, what is destroyed. And I have to gather that strength, that sense of duty every time I returned, because the moment you stepped outside of the airport, your heart breaks. Your heart breaks every time. Cambodia can make a poet out of anyone because the tragedy and the beauty live side by side constantly, and you feel inspired and heartbroken all in the same moment. That's how I would simply describe it.
Hello, and again, thank you for coming. I read your synopsis about the show tonight. I was interested that you had a degree in Southeast Asian studies. I'd be interested to know how to go about it, since I have a personal interest in it as well. In my case, I'm tackling some mysteries left over from the Vietnam conflict, and an art project I'm working on reflects on that. So anyway, I could get started on the studies.
Oh, how you can get started on the study of?
Yes, like is it like an actual college course or where
well,
would I start?
Well, Cornell has one of the best Southeast Asian program and one of the best Asian study program.
Where was that again?
At Cornell University.
Cornell.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's an honor to have you here. Thank you so much. I wanted to know, are your books translated into Khmer?
No, it's not translated into Khmer. Yes, it is very sad. In Cambodia, there's not a real publishing house. There is one publishing group, I think it's a non-profit, Rayum, and they have done a lot in terms of publishing nonfiction books, but I think it's hard, first of all, to translate my work into Khmer, because I think the generation right now with potential writers of the fiction genre is very young. They're still perhaps learning how to write. And then a huge part of the older generation, they're too old to take on this task, especially those who have both has the knowledge of both the languages, English and Khmer, to be able to translate it in a way that I would want this book to be translated. Yes, it is very sad. And sometimes I do toy with the idea that perhaps I should try to translate it myself.
As a modern Cambodian, do you feel any heritage to the Khmer civilization of the 12th century and the Angkorian empire? From your ancestors, do you feel that or do you feel removed from
certainly
it?
Certainly, I think my identity as a Khmer is inseparable from the ancient civilization. I think when we call ourselves Khmer, the image of Angkor, of the temples come to mind. And it's interesting throughout the various regimes or the various governments that have ruled Cambodia, has that image becomes a very powerful force of legitimization for for their rule. But as an individual, as a modern Khmer, I feel that my identity as a Cambodian is inseparable from that whole history.
So this is a follow-up to the translation question. So even though you're not translating into Khmer for the people of Cambodia, do you think there's any interest in hearing or reading these stories of the people who are currently living in Cambodia, or is it still a sensitive topic that it might be a difficult story to read about, or would it bring healing?
Interest among Cambodians living in Cambodia?
In a story like yours, yes.
Yes.
In reading your fiction.
Certainly, I think so. That has been one of the most rewarding experiences for me, is to get letters from young Cambodians living in Cambodia, reading the story in the English language. Because as a work of fiction, both in particular Banyan, with Music of the Ghosts, it was out just two weeks ago. But with Banyan, I think it has provided a safe space for people to learn about their history, safe in the sense of that it's removed from politics, but safe also in the sense of providing a story that they can slip into and that they can call their own, a story that is at once personal, but at the same time give a sense of I wouldn't say distance, but when it gets too much, people can step out of it. That's what fiction does, is that they can say, okay, I'm reading about somebody else's life, and this is a work of fiction, this is a work of literature. But for young Cambodians, there is a lot of interest, tremendous interest, because this is something that their parents cannot talk about and that they cannot fully talk about in Cambodian society, at least not in a way that I think that would get to, get at the roots of the cause, of what happened.
Thank you.
I'd like to hear your perspective on the situation of, for example, some of the ancient traditions, the traditional arts. Are they still being maintained? Are they still flourishing? And it was my understanding that during the Khmer Rouge regime, so many of, as you mentioned, the educated class had been, were killed. So how are the, what is the situation with the traditional arts and crafts?
Actually, there's a great deal, there's been a huge movement of revival of the ancient arts. And I think a huge part of that is through the help of NGOs, of non-governmental organizations, of outside help. I think art in Cambodia is still, perhaps in most part of the world, even here now, is being relegated kind of to the side and pushed to the margin. And so in that sense, it's safe. But once it becomes a force, then the government will start eyeing it again and seeing, how it can be challenged or stopped. But right now, there's a great deal of revival and preservation. The effort to preserve, to not only preserve, but to expand the arts and the ancient arts, both music, the performing arts, such as dances, the traditional dances, traditional music, carving, and now because there's this an intense interest in visiting the ancient temples, this get a lot of young Cambodians interested in the art of making these sculptures again, of carving and so forth. Yes, so in that way, it's good. Yes,
I have another question for you.
Yes,
if I may, I'd be interested to hear your perspective about how the nation has recovered with this generation. I mean, when I think about how the educated class and education and the culture that Cambodia had in even the modern history, 1950s and 60s, how that was all lost. How can a country recover from that? I mean, I know steps are being taken and the UN was in there, but just from your perspective, I'm just in awe about how that can happen.
Yes, well, it's a continuing process, and we have been trying to recover for the last 4 decades since the end of the Khmer Rouge rule. I've always felt that it's not an easy process, and even if we manage to recover, it's never going to be complete. But I have a lot of hope in the younger generations. I see that just through the media, through social media, much more information is available, and therefore the young people are much more brave these days to question the society, to challenge it. And I think we can't recover, we can't change, we can't move forward unless the people within the country themselves have the courage, have the need to really demand for those changes. And so it's a good question. How can, it takes a long time. It takes a very long time. I think that's why with Music of the Ghosts, I really want to get people into thinking about how to respond to violence. You know, we live in a world, in a time in which one form of violence after another competes for attention, and I think it's really important how we react to that. If we react to it with compassion and so forth, I think it will have different consequences than if we respond to violence with violence. And if, an individual respond with violence, and then another individual, and then it takes on a societal scale, it will take generations to recover from the scars of that violence. Yes, but I can't think of, any right now at the moment. I have a hard time with idioms still, It is just, and then slangs are hard for me. And partly the reason Banyan and Music of the Ghosts, these two books are written in the narrative style that I write in is because I feel like I started off in the English language reading British classics, even though I didn't understand what I was reading, I loved the long sentences and the long paragraphs. I feel like The language, you know, the English language can change so fast, and when I write, it is to find a sense of stillness, and so the style that I embrace is the style that gives me that sense of calm, that sense of stillness. But gosh, I can't think of an expression now that is hard for me to understand. I'm sorry. I can't think of one right now. Yes. Yes. But I love taking a certain Khmer phrase and trying to explain it in language, and not only to make sure that the meaning carried through, but to at the same time retain the rhythm of it in the original Khmer. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.